You know, last time we spoke of force into which multiplicity of objects of the world can be reduced. And I said that Sankhya philosophy had made this great contribution in showing that all the multiplicity of objects in the world are nothing but manifestations of one single force. It is a kind of Advaita. Not the ultimate Advaita, but Advaita at least of objects of the world. So how matter that we see can be reduced to water, how water can be reduced to fire, how fire can be reduced to air, and how air can be reduced to ether or akasha or space, and how that can be reduced to the original force. A force which can remain in two conditions, either at rest or in movement. But the same force. Having reached this point, a question can be asked as to whether force itself can be reduced to anything else. If matter, water, fire, air, sky, or space can be all reduced to one force, can force be reduced to anything further? And actually we had seen already earlier, in the earlier chapter, that all force which is in movement can be reduced to pure existence. And we can repeat that argument so that the argument is settled once again more properly. How movement can be reduced to the pure existence. We had said that all movement of force is reducible to time and space. Now all time and space is successive according to our ordinary experience. All time experience is successive. Past, present, future are distinguishable in the movement of time. But all succession implies a very curious kind of paradox. There is an element of continuity in succession. And there is an element of discontinuity, element of division. The very word succession implies a division, distinction between that which has gone, that which is now, and that will be in the future. That division is implied in the concept of succession. And yet there is something like a continuity. If somebody pinches me here, just for a little while, it makes not much effect on me. But if it continues on and on and on and on, the pinch gets intensified. Now, in this movement, there is a continuity. Because of continuity, the pinch becomes intensive. If it was only discontinuous, then the pressure of the pinch of 1 minute is gone, then the pressure of the second pinch will start afresh, then the intensity will not increase. It is because, although there is succession, there is a continuity. So all succession implies a paradox of discontinuity and continuity. Now, how can we explain this paradox? How can there be such a thing which is discontinuous and yet continuous. You might say it's a miracle. How can this be possible? Is there something behind it which can explain this? You are obliged to look behind only when there is a problem. If there is no problem, you never look behind. Because successive movement implies this kind of a problem, we should reconcile continuity and non-continuity. So you are obliged to look behind this. Then you observe that there is something like non-successive extension. That is to say, you realize that there is an extension which is not successive. I have given the example of a small insect walking on the branch of a tree. Now, to that little thing, crossing from one point to the other is a long process, a successive long movement. But to our consciousness, which is larger, which can take the whole branch into one whole, there is no succession. There is extension, but there is no succession in it. You can look at the whole thing, whole segment, at one stroke, as it were. So there is something like a non-successive extension, on the basis of which you can then explain the successive movement. So you therefore realize that there is a kind of non-successive space and non-successive time behind successive movement of time and space. And then we have gone further. All extension implies a ground. And that ground must be beyond extension. If it is only itself an extension, then that extension requires a further ground. Therefore, that which is a ground must be beyond extension. That which is beyond extension, which is non-successive, is the pure existence. The ground of non-successive extension is the pure existence. All extension is nothing but a movement of force. So we have therefore three steps of the argument. Successive space and time, non-successive space and time, and spaceless and timeless pure existence. For space and time disappear. Now the force that is active is therefore reducible to that pure existence. First is a successive time and space. Behind it is non-successive time and space. And behind it is a timeless and spaceless pure existence. In the ninth chapter, we had these three main steps of the argument. This does not mean that the pure existence is opposed to force. It does not mean that the timeless and spaceless is opposed to space and time. It only means that which is spaceless and timeless is capable of space and time. The pure existence is a potent self-existence, not important self-existence. It is existence which is capable of force. If it was important, it would be incapable of a force. It would mean as if a God who is important. It is by virtue of the force that God's potency is regarded as potent. God is capable. God has the potency. Now, this question of pure existence, which is also force, or which contains force, seems to many minds as self-contradiction. A pure existence, which is timeless and spaceless, and a force which moves in time and space, non-successive or successive, how can there be a pure existence which is also force at the same time? This is a question which is often raised. There is a Vedic concept of Adbhuta. Adbhuta means wonderful. In the Veda it is said, the reality is Adbhuta, is wonderful. Once I have spoken to you of the statement made by Indra to Agastya, in which Indra describes the supreme reality. And there Indra says that it is neither today nor tomorrow. That is to say, it is spaceless and timeless. Nanunam asti no shvaha. It is neither today nor tomorrow. Nanunam asti. It is not here, not now. No shvaha. It is not tomorrow. It is spaceless and timeless. Kastad vedati. Who can know it? Who knows it? Yet adbhutam. It is wonderful. It is neither today nor tomorrow. Who knows it? It is wonderful. Why wonderful? Because the second statement says, anyasya chittam abhisantarinyam. It is movable. It is itself timeless and spaceless. Immovable. And yet it is movable. Abhisantarinyam. It is that in which movement takes place. It is one without the second. There is only one reality. And yet it is anyasya chittam. It is a movement in another consciousness. Another consciousness. Anyasya chittam. Utadhitam. When you try to reflect upon it, vinashyati. It disappears. It is elusive. It is so wonderful that when you try to understand it, you can't understand it. In fact, everything in the world is of this nature. The trunk of the elephant has got quite different kinds of legs, pillar-like legs. How can the same elephant, which has got a trunk so mobile, has got almost immobile-like legs? It is the same elephant. Where does that pliability, flexibility of the trunk disappears when it comes to the feet, to the legs? The hugeness of the elephant and the smallness of its eyes, what a great contrast in the same elephant, where the big becomes small and small becomes big. Where does the smallness end and where the bigness begins? Where the bigness begins? In this way, if you look at anything in the world, where does my arm begin in this body? Where exactly does it begin? Where is exactly the dividing point? There is none. And yet it is different. At the point of beginning, you can't decide this is the beginning. Afterwards, you can say this is distinguishable from the whole body. At the point of beginning, it doesn't begin. Such is the wonder of the world. It is the same which is different. Such is the nature of the reality. Therefore, how does the pure existence and the force, where does the force begin from the pure existence? Is it different from the pure existence? If it is different, then there is a very big question. The pure existence is infinite. This also was another concept we have discussed, that pure existence is infinite. Infinite includes everything. There is nothing outside it. If therefore there is a force, it can't be outside the pure existence. That is why in our Indian thought, which admits pure existence and the force as not different from each other, speaks of it in two terms. It is one with the pure existence. It is inherent in the pure existence. It is one because there is only one reality. Therefore, all that is there must be that. Yet that reality is not a monotone. Reality, a monotone is that which has only one color, devoid of potency, devoid of any color. Therefore, it has a difference which is inherent in it. The force which is one with the pure existence and the force which is different from the pure existence in a certain sense is one but also inherent in it. The Veda describes the ultimate reality in the language of a bull, that is the great vision which has been described in the Veda. The reality is imaged as a bull, but bull that is Prishni. Prishni means multicolored. That bull is one. But that bull itself is multicolored. This is the wonder of it. Being one, it is capable of multicolors. It's a multicolored bird, for example. A huge bird which is multicolored. In religious terms, all that I have spoken is philosophical terms, but in religious terms, we have a concept of Shiva and Kali. Shiva is the pure existence. Kali is the force. Now, Shiva and Kali are not two different things. It is not as if Shiva is one and Kali is another. Shiva and Kali are one and the same. And Kali is inherent in Shiva. So at the root of the whole universe lies this miracle, this wonder, a reality which is one, which has within itself, which is itself, and which has within itself, you have to use two terms at the same time, and that is the wonder of it. Which is one with the force, and which has force inherent in it. You have seen the image of Ardhan Arishwara, the sounded image. Where does half the body of Shiva, which is male, end and becomes female? Where does it transform itself into a female? The other half. Ardhan Arishwara is, half is Ishwara, other is
Nari. It is the same one, same Shiva. Sri Aurobindo says that this concept is so rational that it is impossible to reject it. Now the question is, how do you say it is rational? This concept of wonder, that concept which is paradoxical, how can you say that that concept is rational? The answer is, it would be irrational to say that pure existence being one and there being no other than the one, the force is something else. It would be irrational if you first say that reality is one, pure existence, infinite, and there is nothing else than that. Having said it, if you say now that force is other than this, it will be irrational. Therefore, it will be rational to say that all that is there, if there is force, even that force is that pure existence. And still, if you see the difference in it, it will be rational to say that that reality is not monotone. The very nature of that reality need not be monotone. It will be wrong to say it must be monotone, incapable of multicolors. A pure existence which is incompetent, a pure existence which is supreme, and then to say it is incompetent, it would be irrational to suppose so. Therefore, however difficult it might seem to your perception, and it is difficult, that is why he said it is wonderful. There is no hiding the fact that there is a mystery and that there is a paradox. And yet you are obliged to state it. It is somewhat like the modern physicists who are asked the question, what is the ultimate of matter? When you go on examining matter, you ultimately arrive at an atom. And then you ask the question, what is atom? And you break it. And you find in that small atom a full solar system, a nucleus around which electrons are constantly rotating. One atom containing a whole solar system. And as they now go on exploring, they find hundreds of such things inside that little vein. Not only that, but now when they came to the ultimate, this is where they are grappling with the problem. They found that what they call matter, which seemed to be of the nature of a particle, something solid, something that has magnitude, they found that if that magnitude can be broken, and when that is broken, it becomes energy. And energy is not of the nature of particle. And they find it is energy that becomes particle, and particle and broken becomes energy. So its nature is that of a particle which is wave. Particle normally would imply incapacity of a wave. It would cease to be a particle the moment it becomes wave. And the wave would be something opposed to the particle. So if you ask the question, what is this ultimate atom? If you describe it as a particle, it is not true. If you describe it as a wave, it is not true. It is a particle wave, you might say. It is like self-existence with a force of energy. Such is the nature of the world, that is the Adbhuta. In fact, everything in the world has this kind of wonder in it. Therefore, the whole world is regarded as Adbhuta in the Vedanta. The whole world is an Adbhuta. In the Veda, there was a concept of divine Maya. It's like a magic, you might say. The reality is magical. Not therefore illogical or irrational. Why is it that electricity has a positive charge and negative charge? And without these two opposites, the electricity won't function. And where does the negative end and where the positive starts? How the two coexist? Such is the nature of reality. Reality is of this nature, paradoxical nature. Now, this is a very major standpoint which has been described in this chapter. The relationship between pure existence and force. Force is one with the pure existence. Force is inherent in the pure existence. Now, having stated that this is the nature of reality, having first reduced all the multiplicity of objects into one force, having reduced that force into a pure existence, we now have a more comprehensive statement that the pure existence is that with which force is identical and in which force is inherent. This is the clear statement of the wonder that is reality. Having stated this, there are two questions which can be raised. How does the force act? And why does the force act? Now, how is an easier question to answer? How does the force act? The answer is, the force acts in a twofold manner. It acts by assuming a poise of rest, or it takes a poise of movement. It's a twofold nature of force. How it acts? It either takes the poise of rest or it takes a poise of movement. Rest and motion are the two fundamental modes of action of the force. And the whole nature is nothing but an illustration of this twofold movement. Force at rest, force in movement. The second question is, why does it go into rest? Why does it put forward itself in movement? This is a more difficult question to answer. If we were to say, this is one possible answer, that there is no question why. The nature of force is such that sometimes it can take rest and sometimes it can move forward. Such is the nature of force. So the question why it rests and why it goes into motion does not arise. This is the one possible answer to this question. But if it is one with the pure existence, if the force is one with the pure existence, as you already said, it is one, if it is inherent in the pure existence, then the question may arise. We may ask the question, has pure existence anything to do with this double movement of force? And if so, what role has it? And in that role, does the question why arise? Is force independent, although inherent, although inherent in the pure existent? Is it still independent of the pure existent as far as the action is concerned? If it is independent, we are negativing the soulness of the pure existent. The pure existent is the only reality. Then the movement of the force cannot be independent of the pure existent. There is, of course, one theory in the tradition of India which wants to show that although this is inherent in pure existence, movement or not to be in movement is a sole decision of the force. Logically, it is inconsistent, but there is a theory. This is the theory of certain line of tantric thought in India, which says that force, Kali, does the whole world, manifests in the whole world. When she wants, she withdraws from the world. And Shiva is only an observer of all that Kali does. But evidently, this is an irrational theory. Having granted there is only one pure existence, one without the second, that all that is there must be incapable of independence. Therefore, we come to the conclusion that the force, for its movement or for its rest, must be under the control of the pure existence. Now, if it is under the control of the pure existence, if Kali is subordinate to Shiva, although inherent in Shiva, although one with Shiva, then the question can be raised, why is it that Shiva permits the force to move or not to move? If Shiva is capable of controlling, then you can ask the question, why it controls in this fashion? Is there a purpose? Now, this question can be raised only if Kali and Shiva are conscious. Because all idea of purpose is connected with consciousness. If there is a tap which is unconscious, if there is water in it which is unconscious, then when the tap opens, water pours itself down. When it is closed, then the water does not move out. You don't ask the question, why does it move out or why does it not move out? Both are unconscious. Therefore, why there should be a movement or there should not be a movement, this question has a relevance only if there is consciousness in the pure existence and therefore also in the force, which is one with it and which is inherent in it. We can therefore put this question only first of all if you prove that it is conscious. So before answering the question why, we are now obliged to face a more fundamental question. Is pure existence, is a force which is acting, is it conscious? It is only if we can prove it is conscious that we can then ask the question, why does it move or does it go into rest? So let us now concentrate upon this question. Is this pure existent and the force which is inherent in it and one with it, is it conscious? In fact, this whole chapter is written for concentrating upon this question. All that we have said so far is a preliminary. We have now come to the real issue of this chapter. You will see that the title of the chapter is Conscious Force. So the whole theme of this chapter is to discuss whether the force which is acting and which is under the control of the pure existence, is it conscious or unconscious? Now let us therefore pause a little and look at the world once again. And if you look at the world, you find that the large portion of the world, or in fact overwhelmingly large portion of the world, is unconscious. If you look at the whole universe, at least to our experience, we find all the heavenly bodies moving on and on and on. We see the whole earth spinning fast. And we see the lands which are stretching out on the earth, the waters which are rolling in this world, the air that is blowing. In all these phenomena, there is a mute, blind, uncommunicative, simple unconsciousness. Only in one corner, the human corner, in this vast universe, we are a small corner. Our humanity is only a little speck. In that little speck, we find the bubbling of consciousness. It is true, there is a phenomenon called consciousness. It is true. You cannot deny it. To deny it would require consciousness. You can deny the presence of consciousness only through an act of consciousness. Therefore, the presence of consciousness is undeniable. So if anybody says there is no consciousness at all, he is saying something which he does not know what he is saying, which makes no meaning. Because even when he says it with the help of consciousness. He can't say it without help of consciousness. So that there is consciousness is a fact. But there is only one corner. Then the question arises, what is the nature of this consciousness? Now on this question there has been lot of debates. The Sankhya philosophy, of which we spoke earlier, asked this question, what is consciousness? It tried it at most to reduce this consciousness to unconscious movement of force. It tried its best to show that this consciousness is nothing but translation of something that is in unconscious matter or unconscious Prakriti, but could not do it. Sankhya could not reduce consciousness to an origin which is unconscious. Now, modern materialism, studying the same problem, is struggling to prove that consciousness is nothing but a development of matter, which is unconscious. What Sankhya in the ancient times in India tried to do and failed, the modern materialism is once again trying the same thing, trying to show that consciousness is nothing but a development of unconscious matter. One cannot say whether materialism has succeeded or not succeeded. We may say it is struggling. Although it speaks the language of as if it has solved the problem, although it is struggling to answer the question, it normally speaks a language as if it has found the answer by saying that consciousness is nothing but a development of matter. Now, how does it try to show that consciousness is nothing but a development of matter? It does it by two important methods. First argument is, look, where is the phenomenon of consciousness? Just see, go closest to consciousness and you will find it is nearest to physical organs. When the physical organs are in operation, consciousness is generated. Therefore, consciousness is a result of the movement of physical organs. This is the first argument. The second argument is that ultimate reality is matter. Therefore, everything in the world must be derived from ultimate reality. Since consciousness is there in the world, it must be ultimately derivable from matter. Let us repeat these two arguments. If you look at the phenomenon of consciousness from the closest quarters, you find that all consciousness is operating nearest to the physical organs. Not only nearest, but seems to be generated from the physical organs. This is the first argument. Second argument is that ultimate reality is matter. Therefore, anything in the world must be derivable from the ultimate reality. Therefore, if consciousness is a phenomenon in the world, it must be derived from matter. Now, these are the two arguments on which the whole case of materialism rests. Now, these two arguments are very important because today a large portion of humanity holds materialist philosophy in one way or the other. There is a big wave of materialistic thought in the world. And this wave has two very important companions. One is that under this philosophy, it is very easy to advocate the aim of life which seeks only pleasure. Since pleasure is very pleasant, and seeking of pleasure and justification of seeking for pleasure is very pleasant, there is an immediate attraction towards materialism. If you can justify the seeking of pleasure under the basis of materialism, then materialism becomes very pleasant theory. This is a big attraction of materialism in the world. Now, what is the argument of materialism in regard to pleasure? This is the argument. From dust, everybody arises. To dust you return. It is only during a small brief period between dust to dust that you have the consciousness. In this consciousness, there are two great phenomena of pleasure and pain. Where pleasure is pleasant, agreeable, desirable, which you automatically desire, then it follows that if you have to choose between pleasure and pain, why should you not choose pleasure? Because whether you choose pleasure or pain, ultimate result is dust. Therefore, why should you not choose pleasure? Therefore, choose pleasure. This is the argument of the materialist. If the choice between pleasure and pain were to make a difference afterwards, instead of becoming dust, you were to become something else, then one can have an argument that he has to choose pain between pleasure and pain. But in either case, ultimate result is only matter dust. Then why should you not, during this brief period that is given to you, why should you choose pain at all? Reject pain altogether, or reduce it if you can't reject altogether, reduce it to the minimum. Maximize as much pleasure as possible. Snatch as much pleasure as possible from this brief period. Why not? Because it's so pleasant. Now, this is a great companion of materialism. Mind you, logically, you could also argue that ultimately, if you have a choice between pleasure and pain, and both are to reduce into dust, there is nothing illogical if you choose pain. Nothing illogical about it. If somebody says that ultimately, even by pain I will go to dust, even by pleasure I will go to dust, it is true, I like pleasure very much, but what is illogical about choosing pain? Nothing illogical. Both are equally possible. Both can be chosen. In either case, you will go to dust. So why not to choose pain also? Why not? One can argue that also. But it doesn't please human beings. It's a question of being having pleasure in it. Therefore, you can say that the human being is attracted towards materialism. Therefore, there is an automatic choice in favor of materialism because of this reason. Not necessarily logical, but which is not illogical either. Therefore, this companion of materialism has a great hold upon humanity today. Now, this hold has become even much greater because of another reason. That the methods of seeking pleasure in today's world have become much easier than they were in the previous times. The duration of pleasure today can be made as long as you like, as never before. It's a special time in which we are living, and therefore the hold of materialism being so strong. You just enter into a room and you can switch on a television. It is so easy as that. And have any kind of pleasant scenario before you as you like. You can choose it. The whole night you can watch it. No problem. You are no more dependent upon the visit of a dancer to your house. She has to return. Not at all. Akbar had never this kind of pleasure. In spite of being the emperor of this great country, as a domestic servant today, who can switch on the television for the whole night and watch it, and there is no problem at all. So the methods of seeking pleasure today are so easy, and the duration can be as long as you want, within only a few limitations. Because of these two reasons, materialism has become very powerful. There is a second reason. Materialism is very easy to prove. You don't need to go through a great exercise of the kind that you have been going through. What a difficult exercise that we had to go through. To work the whole world, to reduce it to space and time, which is successive, then to see it non-successive, then to see the pure existence, to see the paradoxes, and then to reconcile them and to see the wonder of it. All these are very difficult procedures. Materialism is as easy as kicking a football. Who can deny the reality of the football when you kick it? You can just kick it and show, look, this is matter. If you want to show pure existence, which is spacious and timeless, can you show it like a football? Whereas matter can be shown as easily as you can show a football by kicking it. It is so easy to prove materialism. As Sri Aurobindo says, the materialist has an easier field. And its success is immediate. You can just show the successful argument of materialism. What is it? You open your eyes and you see matter everywhere. So when materialism is philosophically so easy to prove, when materialism is so pleasant because it gives you justification for seeking pleasures which are now so easy to obtain, and the duration of which can be very long, these two companions of materialism reinforce materialism. Reinforce those two arguments which I have given you, that consciousness emerges nearest to physical organs. And secondly, that matter is ultimate reality, therefore consciousness is derivable from matter. These two arguments. Now, in this scenario, if somebody wants to even argue with a materialist, materialist simply says, why do you trouble me? I have just now told you my arguments. I also advise you to enjoy the world now. Why do you bother about anything else? Therefore, any kind of argumentation with materialist becomes difficult. He has not time for it because he is impatient. I have told you to prove the existence of matter is as easy as kicking a football. I have proved it. If you go further, I have also shown you that all consciousness of which you are talking is nothing but nearest to physical organs. And they are physical in character. So consciousness is nothing but generated from the physical organs. Having done this, why do you take away my time in discussing anything further? Now, against this position, now Sri Aurobindo says, materialist is committing a rustic error. Mark the words that Sri Aurobindo has used. Materialist is committing a rustic error. Rustic is one who is a villager, uncultured, and who is easily tired when you want him to do some difficult work.
Pardon? Difficult work? Not physical work.
Well, whatever. Even physically, sometimes if he is easily resting somewhere and telling him to do big work, he will say, no. I am resting now. I don't want to do any work. A rustic normally does not want to do much work. Much labor. Who is easily tired? Yes, it is tamasic. Rustic is normally a tamasic man. Imagine a rustic being brought to a railway station. A rustic is brought to a railway station where he sees a huge train at the top of which is an engine. And he goes on watching at the engine. And he finds that when the piston moves, the steam is coming out. And seeing this again and again, he proclaims that the cause of the steam is the piston. Let the piston move, the steam comes out, the piston stops, There is no steam coming out.
Now, if you were to tell him, look, my dear friend, this is not true. Piston is not the cause of the steam. Steam is the cause of the piston. He will simply laugh at you and say, my dear friend, this is not true. Don't you see, when piston moves, the steam comes out. When the piston moves, does not move, there is no steam. What is the cause of this steam? Then if you tell him, look, my dear friend, there are deeper things. But the rustic says, look, I have no time for all this, deeper things. I see very clearly here, I have shown you, this is what is happening. What are deeper things? Besides, train is so beautiful, engine is so beautiful, riding is so beautiful. Why do you want to take me away from all this pleasure and engage me in a kind of a conversation, a dialogue, where you say there are deeper things? Such is the condition of the materialist. He is a rustic who sees a phenomenon which you cannot deny, which is so convincing. It is near the physical organs. When they move, consciousness emerges. It's a fact. Now, if you tell him, look, my dear friend, it is the other way around. It is the consciousness which moves the physical organs, not the other way around. He says, it's not true. You close all your physical organs. Is that consciousness? Nothing. You go to sleep, there is no consciousness. All the organs are finished. So where is the question? There is no argument possible. Now if you say, go behind, go inward, there are deeper things. Your intention is very good. You want rustic to be educated. You want him to learn that there is a whole mechanics behind it. That there is, first of all, a huge store of coal that you have to fill up in the engine. A huge store of water that you have to fill up in it. Then the water has to be boiled to a very high degree. Then the steam comes out of it. And that steam forces the piston to move up and down. Now all these are deeper things which you have to explain. But that takes time. But if you are searching for the truth and nothing but the truth, then ultimately you have got to prevail upon the materialist that he has got to find time to go deeper. And you must make this effort because both you and he are going to ultimately gain out of it. If it was only a kind of a dialogue which has not much meaning, then it's a different matter. If you can go really deeper and arrive at quite a different conclusion, then bigger consequences are going to follow. Maybe that after seeking for pleasure, you are at present thinking that you are going to rust. Maybe that ultimately, as a result of deeper inquiry, after having pleasure, after bearing the pain, you may be able to arrive at a greater ecstasy, which you will miss out completely if you don't take this trouble. That there is a possibility of a greater ecstasy which you can never have if you really remain only at this point, standing on the platform and watching at the piston, the steam, and not taking the trouble of going into the engine and seeing the inner mechanism. If you don't take the trouble, then the ultimate result is that you will miss out the great ecstasy which is awaiting every one of us. So the question is whether you want ecstasy or whether you want dust after having all the pleasure that you can have. You can have ecstasy here, you can have ecstasy after, both.
This is the choice, and since this choice is much better, if you can ultimately show it, then this whole effort is worth doing it. This is the point which has to be made to the materialist. It is only then that the materialist might even give a kind of a hearing to you. There is basically a kind of a refusal even to hear you because of the arguments that I have just now advanced. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo has spoken of the denial of the materialist. The materialist simply denies. There is an automatic refusal to listen to you. And we need to prove that there is a greater thing to be achieved. If you can show that there is not matter as ultimate reality, but consciousness as ultimate, and that consciousness is capable of infinities of intensities, and with these infinities of intensities, you can have correspondingly infinities of delight. That is why in the Taittiriya Upanishad, we have a description of delight. There is one full section on delight. And says what kind of delight the Brahman, the pure existence, possesses. Immeasurable delight. That is a great contribution of the Upanishad. It has described the delight. One day when we shall have time, we shall refer to this section of delight in the Taittiriya Upanishad. It is at this point that we have to have a dialogue with the materialists. Now, it is this dialogue we shall have next time. It's a long dialogue. If it was a short dialogue, I would have finished right now. But I want to do it in some detail because this is one of the major problems of the world today. And this dialogue is very important. Every step of the dialogue is very interesting. So we have to take this dialogue very seriously. It will require 1 hour by itself. So we shall take it up next time. All right.
When the force is achieved, will we call the existence, the pure existence is immobile? So when the force is achieved, is it identical to the same?
It is.
It is.
It is the same. It is.
It is the same.
The force and pure existence are not two realities.
So when it is achieved, it is the pure existence.
It is the pure existence. But pure existence is such. There is
change.
Manifest itself as force.
And yet we may address at the same time.
That's all. The force that works is pure existence.
Sure.
And yet pure existence can manifest itself as force. That is the wonder of it.
Remaining at rest, it can
manifest. Can yet manifest. That is the wonder of that reality.
How is the mention of the Shiva dancing related to this? It's in the chapter.
Yes. Where Sri Aurobindo says that Shiva and Kali are not two but one.
And before that he says that
the whole world is nothing but a dance of Shiva.
How does
you have force, the dance requires a force of action. And Shiva himself is immobile.
Means the inherent
of the whole thing.
Okay.